This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
The election is over. That is the rule of law. That is our constitutional process. Those who refuse to accept the rulings of our courts are at war with the Constitution.
That's Republican Representative Liz Cheney last week, right before she was purged from her House GOP leadership position for her defiance of Donald Trump's big lies about the election. Well, Akhil Reed Amar is one of the nation's most celebrated and respected constitutional law scholars, and he joins us now. Professor Amar, when you heard Liz Cheney saying those words, that members of her party are at war with the Constitution, what did you think?
Thanks for having me, and it's so amazing you asked that question, because exactly 2 weeks ago, I was at an AEI, American Enterprise Institute, event. It's supposed to be secret, but word immediately leaked out of this event, and Liz Cheney and Paul Ryan at the noon discussion went into all of this, and that's when Liz Cheney, she had tweeted about this the day before, so she started telling, you know, all the donors in the room and other leading politicians that this big lie was poisonous, and in order to save the soul of the Republican Party, they had to make a pivot, and there were gasps in the room. And again, I'm not talking out of school, because all of this became public within hours of the event. So it's so amazing, and it's additionally amazing because I immediately flashed back to a book that her mother wrote, Lynn Cheney, who's a historian, about James Madison. And I talk about Lynn Cheney and James Madison in my new book. Here's the big point. Ours is a two-party system. The two parties were not originally contemplated when the framers adopted the Constitution, but very soon thereafter, they emerged. And when you have a party system, there's going to be often a huge tension between party loyalty and fidelity to conscience or the Constitution or just the truth or the courts. And that's not unique to today's Republican Party. I could talk about if you're a conscientious Democrat. I happen to be a Democrat, but let's imagine that you're very strongly pro-choice, just as a matter of conscience, and you think Roe versus Wade, for example, was wrongly decided, and the Supreme Court just today decided to hear another case about abortion. Well, life is going to be difficult for you in the Democratic Party, just as life is difficult for Liz Cheney in the Republican Party when she went with conscience. And her mother wrote a book about James Madison, and it's a good biography, but I criticize Cheney's biography and some others because they don't tell the story, as I do in my book, about how Thomas Jefferson and James Madison formed a political party. And after they formed the political party, that deformed some of their views. They originally began as anti-slavery people, but because the party they formed basically had a Southern base, by the end of their lives, they became basically pro-slavery in order to get in line with their party.
Well, so let me just jump in here and let folks know that Professor Amar is, as I mentioned earlier, one of the nation's most respected constitutional law scholar. He's the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, has actually had many members of Congress as students in his classes over the years, author of a number of books about the Constitution, the most recent of which, and why we're gathered here today, is called The Words That Made Us, America's Constitutional Conversation from 1760 to 1840. And there's a lot specifically in the book, Professor Amar, that I want to dig into in a little bit. But I think we're in such a pressing moment of U.S. history that I want to stick with what's happening now for a little while longer, if I could.
Sure.
Because, so first of all, just clearly, answer if you could. Do you think members of the Republican Party, as Cheney said, are at war with the United States Constitution?
I personally think they're at war with the truth, and that's an even bigger thing to be at war with. And yes, I also think they're at war with the Constitution, because here are the two most fundamental elements of the American Constitution, or maybe three. The Constitution has to endure. It has to go on. In order for that to happen, there have to be fair elections whose results are abided by all concerned, even the losers, and open, robust, free speech. So I told you just a while ago about how Jefferson and Madison formed a political party that deformed their conduct. They originally began as anti-slavery folks, and then they became increasingly pro-slavery because that's what where the party base was. Why did they form their political party? In part because John Adams and his supporters, who themselves were a kind of a party, made it a crime to criticize John Adams. So you can't have a world where one party tries to criminalize the other party, which John Adams did, which Donald Trump threatened to do even before he was elected with a chance of lock her up. So you have to have free speech. You have to have fair elections, and the two go together because you can't have fair elections without free speech. And then you have to have people accepting the legitimacy of the verdict.
Right.
And at the end of the day, John Adams did leave office, although he didn't show up for the inauguration. And there are echoes, actually, in 1800, 1801, of what happened in the most recent election. The story I tell in the book is actually the transition in 1800, 1801 from one political party to another wasn't quite as tame and peaceful as people remember it as being. Actually, the system came closer to melting down than most people understand today. But you have to have fair elections, and people have to abide by the results of those elections. And when they don't, it's called a civil war.
Well, yes, which we had in 1861, and people are wondering if we're on the brink of that, some kind of version of that now. And so it's so interesting that you mentioned John Adams, because I would actually also look more broadly, and I know you do, obviously you do too, that to me, look, I'm a huge fan of the Constitution. By virtue of my birth, I was a citizen of the day I was born in this country. But in fifth grade, when I learned about the Constitution, it was the day I became sort of an impassioned American because of what it stands for. And part of the reason for that is that baked into the Constitution is this Enlightenment era notion, right? That people of goodwill who believe in ideas that founded a nation, who believe in the institutions of government, can create a good nation. And it's so funny because to me, the founding fathers themselves knew the power of what can happen when people reject those very institutions of government. You can look at the revolution, right, as a demonstration of that, the rejection of the institution of monarchical power over the colonies. So I wonder, where in the Constitution, is there anything in the Constitution that says it can withstand the attack that comes with the rejection of institutional legitimacy? Can it withstand institutional collapse?
Well, I think it can. But before I give you the reasons, I have to tell you, as you were saying that, I'm thinking, amen, sister. And what you were saying, literally, hairs started standing up on the back of my neck, because the story you just related is exactly mine. My parents were born in India under the British Raj, but I was lucky enough under British rule to be the first generation in my family born in the United States. The day of my birth, I'm a U.S. citizen. I didn't deserve it. It was just this gift given to me. And when I was literally in fifth and sixth grades, just like you, I discovered the Constitution because my parents, I grew up in California, took me first to Philadelphia when I was in fifth grade, and I went to Independence Hall. And then sixth grade, we went to Washington, D.C., and I saw the National Archives and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And we went to the White House and Mount Vernon, and we had lunch with our local congressman. My dad's a doctor, and he was one of my dad's patients. So, and that's when I said, oh, my God, now I understand how different my life is from my cousins, many of whom were not lucky enough to be born in the United States. So that's the great gift that the Constitution gave you and me, birthright citizenship. And then you ask, well, can it survive? It can't guarantee anything because it's just a piece of paper. you know, that's ultimately up to us. And the last word in the title of my book is the words that made us. And it's also a pun. It's the words that made the U.S. It's what the Constitution is, what we have in common, which is why it's so important that we all choose to abide by it, because if we don't, it's called Beirut, it's called Gaza and Palestine, and it's called civil war. It's a war of all against all, in which life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, to quote Thomas Hobbes. Unless there are rules that bind us all that we agree to live by, those rules are the Constitution. That's why I wrote this book, because it's a book, whether you're liberal or conservative, coastal or heartland person, we have to all agree to abide by these rules. And we have to choose that. I mean, we can reject it, and now the alternative would be pretty ugly. Right. And I think for all its flaws, and it is an imperfect document, it's a document worthy of our allegiance. It was better when framed than anything else in the world at the time. It was deeply flawed. It has improved over time with amendments that have ended slavery and promised equality and given women equal voting, and in my lifetime got rid of poll tax disfranchisement and other exclusions. And that process is still ongoing. But the paper can't guarantee its own success. But I think it can enable its own success if we choose, as we would be wise to follow it and live by it.
And at the same time, again, per the title of your book, The Words That Made Us, you're also saying that the Constitution is the thing that binds all Americans together. And that's not something worth letting go of. So, Professor Akhil Reed Amar, stand by for just a moment. We have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're talking with Akhil Reed Amar. He's a celebrated constitutional law scholar at Yale University, author of many books on the Constitution. His latest is The Words That Made Us, America's Constitutional Conversation from 1760 to 1840. And if you're wondering why he stops at 1840, it's because, Professor Amar, I presume more books are coming about the remainder of America's constitutional history. But let me ask you, first of all, why is it that you call it a constitutional conversation, the nation's constitutional conversation?
Because as I began to study the backstory of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and before that, the imperial debate between colonists and Britain, it became increasingly clear to me that basically Americans talk themselves into becoming a people. When I start my book in 1760, America doesn't quite exist as any sort of formal idea or institutional reality or lived identity. People are Massachusetts people, or even within that they might call themselves Bostonians, but they're Massachusetts men, or they're Virginians, or they're New Hampshiremen. They're 13 separate colonies. They've been founded at very different times for very different purposes. They're in some ways as different as, let's say, in 1930, India and Kenya and New Zealand are all part of the British Empire, but there's not some strong sense of identity between people in India and Kenya and New Zealand. That's the new world in 1760. And over the course of 15 years, Americans talk themselves into becoming a people, into becoming Americans. This book begins with the story of how New Worlders become Americans, and they do it in a conversation with newspapers as central to that conversation. All the leading founders are actually newspaper people. Ben Franklin is a publisher. If he were alive today, his name would be Rupert Murdoch. Alexander Hamilton writes...
Rupert Murdoch.
Yes, he has a chain of newspapers. He's a newspaper magnate. He's many things. He's a great scientist. He's a philanthropist. But he makes his fortune as a newspaper man.
Oh, that part I don't disagree with. But in terms of... say the effect that Fox News is having on our democracy, perhaps the ghost of Benjamin Franklin might take issue with that.
Since you mentioned Fox News, that would be Thomas Jefferson, who creates a partisan network of newspapers in order to combat John Adams. So all these guys have deep connections to the newspaper industry. They're newspaper scribblers or newspaper owners, or in the case of the indispensable person, George Washington, he reads more newspapers than anyone else in America or probably in the world. America has more newspapers per capita than anywhere in the world, including Britain. And it's because of newspapers and pamphlets and letters. It's because of a conversation back and forth across colonies, initially between New World and the Old World and London. It's that back and forth conversation, that argument every week, In newspapers and letters, is what gives birth to the American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence, state constitutions, and ultimately the U.S. Constitution.
Mm. And so how, regarding the process of the ratification of the Constitution itself, you call 1788 a pivotal year, not just in the history of this continent, but for humanity more broadly. And why is that?
Yes, it's the hinge of human history. It's the year that changed everything. And here's why. Because there's so many things we take for granted, like democracy, self-government. Well, before the American Revolution, almost no one ever in the history of the world was part of a self-governing society. Most of the people in the planet for most years in most places were basically governed by force or at best custom. They were governed by kings, emperors, czars, sultans, Mughal lords, tribal chiefs, mainly thugs who had military power, who had, you know, bigger clubs, later guns, and or maybe priests who just claimed to rule because they claimed a pipeline to God. So princes and priests ruled the world almost everywhere, almost always. Yes, there were a few tiny Greek city-states that 500 years before Christ managed to have democracy on a very small scale. Athens, most famously, in the Periclean age, under the Cleisthenic constitution. But they collapsed. Rome, before it became an empire, was a republic, actually, for a couple hundred years, but it collapsed. And when the American Revolution breaks out, the only people in the world who even come close to governing themselves are the Brits, who have a king that no one voted for and a House of Lords that no one voted for and a big established church, and the Swiss, who are a bunch of sheep herders, and they're probably more sheep than people, and so it's not a very big society. And then, in 1776, there's a revolution, but the Declaration of Independence isn't put to a vote. And none of the state constitutions that emerge in 1776 is put to a vote. And the Articles of Confederation, which is the first version of USA 1.0, like the modern EU today, European Union or NATO, isn't put to a vote. But in 1788, the hinge of human history, we, the people of the United States, up and down a continent, put this proposal to a vote. And no one had ever done that before in world history. Not the Greeks, not the Romans, not the Brits, not the Swiss. No one had ever done that. And the world would never be the same because, Meghna, the world that you and I inhabit today is a world in which democracy reigns over half the planet. When my parents are born, there's no democracy in India. It's an imperfect democracy there, but there is one today in a way that there wasn't when my parents were born, and they're still alive. And all of Eastern Europe, has self-government in a way that it didn't before. And Central Europe and Western Europe, at the time of the Constitution, France is an absolutist tyranny, and now it's an impressive public, and I claim that is because of the hinge of human history, the year 1788, where, to borrow a phrase, we, the people of the United States, did in actual fact ordain and establish the Constitution by putting it to a vote and by allowing there to be a massive conversation, pro and con. You would oppose this proposal and you weren't going to be basically exiled or banished. Mm-hmm. You were going to be listened to, and some of your big ideas would become the Bill of Rights, and some of your big leaders would eventually become presidents and vice presidents and justices.
Well, so much to talk with you about.
Wow.
Professor Amar.
People talking to each other, listening to each other.
Well, so I wonder, though, first of all, okay, I just have to know that you mentioned the Roman Republic. Exactly the same thing as, obviously not exactly the same thing as what you're talking about regarding the Constitution. But the Roman Republic lasted, the period of the Republic lasted, what, 4.5 centuries? We're not even close to that yet. And already there are concerns. Well, already we've had a civil war in this country, and there are now contemporary concerns about attacks on the Constitution. So let it be explicitly stated that even though the U.S. Constitution, as you call it, might be the hinge of human history, there's nothing that guarantees that this country doesn't even have as much experience as the Romans did in trying to keep that republic.
There is no guarantee, as we talked about before, but let me say one thing about America compared to Rome. Which is that first, when it was a republic, before it became an empire, it wasn't that socioeconomically diverse. There were basically people in one small city-state who ruled Rome itself, so it didn't have, when it basically conquers the world, it becomes an empire. But even Rome, for all its glory, and Americans are emulating the Romans. That's why we call it the Senate. You go to Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., and you see a lot of classical architecture. The age limits, 25, 30, 35, are actually loosely modeled on a Roman thing called a course of honor. So, of course, they're thinking very much about even the very word republic, res publica, is a Latin for the people's thing. But here's one thing that America does that Romans never do. Americans, beginning in 1775, for the first time in the world, start to seriously talk about ending slavery, not just freeing slaves. The ancient world, slavery has existed for most of the world, in most places. That's not unique to America. It doesn't begin in 1619. Most places, for most of human history, have had forms of unfreedom. And there were ideas about freeing individual slaves. If you're inclined to the serious, think Ben-Hur, which is about, Charlton Heston being enslaved and becoming free. Or if you're inclined to comedy, think A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum with Zero Mostel, this conniving slave trying to engineer his own freedom. So there is the idea of emancipation, manumission, individual slaves being freed. You can see it in the Old and the New Testament. But only Americans in 1775 originate this amazing revolutionary idea of ending slavery. That's an idea that for the first time, a society to end slavery forms in Philadelphia in 1775. It's eventual presidents will be Ben Franklin, who signs the Declaration of Independence the next year, and Benjamin Rush, who signs the Declaration of Independence. And by 1780, Pennsylvania will have adopted a constitution that phases slavery out altogether, not just freeing slaves, but ending slavery. And you're from Boston, and the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780 says all people are born free and equal. And by 1783, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court says that means that slavery has to end in is hereby ended in Massachusetts, and New Hampshire does the same thing, and that's going to be followed by Connecticut and Rhode Island and eventually New Jersey and New York. So that's something that the Romans never did, that the Americans began and begin early on.
Okay, but point taken about the state-level abolishment of slavery in this country. But, you know, when you say 1775, it was 90 more years until the sin of slavery was abolished from the nation. And it had to come through a civil war. And so I wonder, though, the very example that you give, Professor Amar, does it not show how, you know, we learn about the Constitution as this great document that shows how a nation can come together through compromise. But it in as the governing law of the land, is also a compromised document because of its initial allowances for slavery, for the disenfranchisement of women, if we want to expand who the we are in we the people. I mean, what you're saying is that this actually could have been avoided.
Yes.
But it wasn't. They chose the continuation of the enslavement of human beings over a greater moral cause that you said was beginning to be undertaken in 1775.
Well put. So let's talk about the two issues you identify, which are two of the three biggest areas of exclusion that I discuss in great length in the book. And one is women. We'll talk about that in just a minute, but let's talk about slavery first. I claim that for all the impressive things that the founders did, they really made one enormous mistake, which is going to eventually lead to a civil war and almost the destruction of everything that they succeeded in doing, and that's that they failed to put slavery on a path of ultimate extinction. And my claim is they could have had a different compromise. It would have been a compromise, but it would have been a better compromise. The Constitution, at its best, borrows from state constitutions that emerged as early as 1776. So it's not coming from the mind of James Madison, it's coming from the American experience. And the best, and on issue after issue, the Constitution copies the best state practice. Written constitutions, that's what 11 states have. Bicameral legislatures, all the states except Pennsylvania and Georgia. Three branches of government, judicial review, regular elections, a census, which Pennsylvania has and New York has, but the others don't. On issue after issue, the Constitution actually follows the best state practice, and this was smart. They're listening to the American people. They forget to adopt a Bill of Rights, and immediately in the ratification period, folks say, hey, dudes, you forgot the rights, which we have state bills of rights, and they fix that mistake. The best state constitutions, like the Pennsylvania one that I mentioned, put slavery on a path of ultimate extinction. It was a compromise. They didn't get rid of it immediately, but they basically said, we will phase it out. And in my view, what the framers should have done is, in effect, instead of giving extra credit to slave states forever, for every slave that you have, you get credit in the House of Representatives and the Electoral College. Not full credit, but still three-fifths credit, which means that for every slave that you kidnap from Africa, bring across the Atlantic in a hellish middle passage with bullwhips and chains, for every person that you do that to, you actually get more votes in the House of Representatives and the Electoral College. And that was horrible, and there was an alternative. The alternative would have been, okay, we got to keep the South on board. It's important for various reasons. In order to beat the British, we have to have an alliance, but we should phase it out. Three-fifths now, but you know, next decade, two-fifths, eventually zero-fifths. We should phase it out, and they failed to do that.
You tell me why? Because, I mean, what in that conversation that you were talking about led to the failure of ideas like that?
Because if you ask me today who understands pharmaceutical prices best, patent policy, whether it's on AIDS medication or acne medication or COVID medication, Big Pharma is going to understand drug prices best. And big oil is going to understand, big carbon is going to understand oil prices best. So the deep Southerners at Philadelphia, actually, this is what their living is based on, and they were more clever, actually, and more emphatic and dogged. And the North thought that when many anti-slavery people when the international slave trade is phased out, which it was allowed there was a sort of a phase out. By 1808, the Constitution says the international slave trade can be phased out. It will stop importing slaves from Africa. And a lot of Northerners thought, when we stop the importation of slaves from Africa, slavery will actually die out. They didn't foresee quite the cotton gin, which is going to make slavery massively profitable in the Deep South, and they didn't foresee that actually you don't need to have slave importation for slavery to keep existing because slaves are reproducing at a very high rate in America. So they didn't understand slavery as well as the Deep South did, and it's basically South Carolina and Georgia who are the big culprits in my story on this. The Virginians are people who have slaves, but they think slavery is wrong, the leading Virginians, Jefferson, Madison, Washington. So that's why they blew it, because they didn't quite do it. But,
Professor Amar, I'm 5 seconds away from a break, so let me just take that quick break and we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Akhil Reed Amar. He's a Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, one of this nation's most celebrated constitutional law scholars. He's written many books about the United States Constitution, and his newest one is called The Words That Made Us, America's Constitutional Conversation from 1760 to 1840. And Professor Amar, I mean, you go into exquisite detail about all the major issues in the early creation and conversation around the Constitution, slavery, women's enfranchisement, et cetera. We don't unfortunately, we don't have time to go into adequate detail on any particular any one of those. But today in the course of this conversation. But what I wanted to do is use your scholarship as a springboard to explore what the Constitution or how it serves modern America, how it serves what the United States is in 2021. So let me put it this way. If you were to write a new supreme governing document for the land now, for the U.S. today, is the Constitution what you would write?
So I wouldn't want to write it for America top down. I would need ordinary Americans to buy into it. That's the most important thing that I would try. And I mentioned before that ancient societies like Athens were democratic, but precisely they gave the power to write the Constitution to one man. They called him the lawgiver, Solon, and he handed the law down from on high. I wouldn't want to do that. I don't think one person, no matter who that person is going to be smarter than all of us together, the wisdom of crowds. So if you asked me, and today, we've already you know, we've been conditioned by the Constitution. It shapes how we think, and you can't kind of ignore that, just like you can't ignore like where the Mississippi River is or the Rocky Mountains are. So I think what I would modify your hypothetical just a little bit to say, what amendments, given that we already have a status quo, you know, we're not just floating in somewhere in someone's imagination, given they already have a status quo, what things would I, you know, love to persuade my fellow citizens we might want to modify? I would say, oh, the biggest thing that I don't love, that the biggest thing, so I think actually direct election of the president would be a good thing. Mm. And it's how we pick, but here's why I think so. It's how we pick every governor, one person, one vote. I look to actually what Americans actually do. I want ERA. Why do I want it? Because state constitutions have ERA. It's, you know, I would want someone who was not lucky enough like you and me to be born in the United States to be, if they come here legally and they play by the rules, to be eligible to be president in 35 years. And we allow them to be governors, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jennifer Granholm. So I often look to state experiences, which are American democracy in action, to try to think about how the federal might be better.
So let me just jump in here, though, because I'm really glad you pointed that out, because it's, in fact, it shows... The list that you just shared with us shows the paucity of those same social and economic rights in the Constitution itself, right? I mean, I looking globally, for example, I think the U.S. Constitution kind of is almost a standout in what it does not guarantee, right? There is no ERA. There's no gender equality rights in the United States Constitution. I think of all written constitutions worldwide, there are only a couple of dozen that don't guarantee that now. And the United States is one of them. And part of the reason why, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that even though, yes, we do have these amendments, this process of amending the Constitution, it's actually quite hard to do so. In fact, would you argue that it's too hard to make modernizing changes to the Constitution?
I used to think that, and I've changed my mind. And the one other one. So here are the four that, you know, because I didn't mention the biggest one, but I'd like the federal constitution to look more like the state. So ERA, eligibility of naturalized citizens to be chief executive, just like you can be governor in Michigan or California if you're a naturalized citizen. Direct election, just like we pick governors by direct election in states. And I think the Senate is malapportioned, and none of our state upper houses are malapportioned that way. Mm. So those would be my big four, and I look at state constitutions as my template. I used to think, now state constitutions are easy to amend, and the federal constitution is harder to amend, and I used to think, oh, the federal constitution should be easy to amend, just like states. I've changed my mind for two reasons. One, states have had a lot of bad amendments as well as good ones. I'm from California, and some of the amendments have been good and some of them have been bad. Almost all the federal amendments have been good. They've added to liberty and equality, Bill of Rights, ending slavery, women's suffrage, get rid of poll tax disfranchisement. Second, and related point, is if you ask most Americans which constitution they have more loyalty to, I think they would actually say the federal over the state. So when I'm a young person, I say, oh, things could be so much better, constitution's too hard to amend, I've got all these brilliant ideas, and they're never going to get through. Now I'm an old guy, and I think, oh, constitution could be so much worse. At the states, all sorts of bad ideas are happening. If the constitution were easily amendable today, maybe it'd be better, but maybe it'd actually take us in the wrong direction. In my lifetime, amendments were proposed to make marriage only one man and one woman. George W. Bush proposed such a thing, and it had majorities, but not super majorities to actually succeed. Or there was an amendment proposed to make flag burning a crime. I think that's a mistake because it cuts into free speech, and that's a bad thing. So I've changed my mind on that now. And on ERA, I'm in favor of, emphatically. I think we should do it today. Let's you and I agree today that we're going to try to, you know, get people to be motivated by that. Truth be told, it won't make that much of a difference in what courts do, because courts have properly construed the 14th Amendment to provide for women's equality and gay equality as well as racial equality. But I'd rather have it explicit in the Constitution.
Okay, but Professor Ma, I've got to just jump in here, because I feel like I'm hearing two different arguments from you, and tell me if I'm mishearing this. Because on the one hand, you are championing, celebrating in this book the conversation that went on in the 18th century to craft this idea of America. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, now you're saying, well, I also don't want it to be too easy to modify the Constitution. Do you not have faith in the nation's ability now to have those same empowering conversations over the governing laws of the land?
Oh, I do. But remember, they immediately added 10 amendments to the Constitution within 2 years of ratifying the thing. So constitutional amendment is not impossible. They added 10 right after ratifying. My claim is they made amendments difficult to do compared to ordinary legislation, and that was actually a feature and not a bug that, it turns out, I now think, a good thing. We shouldn't amend our document unless there's deep consensus about the direction of amendment. And the problem right now in America is there's not sufficient consensus to actually move us strongly one way or one direction or the other. So given that, we should be hesitant, because remember, the losers in any amendment process are part of the society as well. Yeah. And if you lightly amend, 51-49, that doesn't always actually work out so well. So that's why I've changed my mind on this over time.
Okay.
I now think it's wise to require a strong consensus before we amend, but not an impossible consensus. And almost all the amendments we've added have been really good ones, and none have been bad ones. And that's not true at the state level, where it's too easy to amend.
Well, arguably. is there a lack of consensus nationally, or the appearance of the lack of consensus because of something else in the Constitution, like the way government is structured in the Constitution? And here's why I ask that, because there are constitutional scholars out there who would say that the United States right now at the federal level, their argument is, for example, I was looking both at constitutional scholars who've been published by at the Hoover Institution and on the right, and The Nation on the left, so right, who would say that, for example, the nation is poorly governed right now because of the way Congress is structured. You talked about malapportionment, but that Congress, in fact, is not actually even wired down to the level of what's written in the Constitution to solve problems of a national interest, because it's built to avoid the tyranny of the majority. And instead, it's wired to then allow parochial legislators to answer to only their own local special interests. So you will never have the appearance of consensus for big issues of national import, of which we face far more today, I would argue, in the 21st century than we ever did in the 18th century.
Well, in my lifetime, we amended the Constitution multiple times in the 1960s. So I don't think look, it's easy to blame the Constitution rather than looking in the mirror and blaming ourselves. Okay, here, the fundamental problem, in my view, is that some of my fellow citizens are kind of crazy. And until they get over that, this is where we began with Liz Cheney. The problem isn't the Constitution. The problem is that there are lots of people today who wanting to move us in the wrong direction. And no constitution that wants to be democratic can solve that problem with a magic wand. The problem isn't, I would say, the structure of Congress, which was not a problem in the 1960s when we did amendments, or the 19-teens when we did amendments, or the 1860s when we did amendments, or the 1800s when we did amendments, or the 1790s when we did amendments. The problem is not the structure of constitutional amendment. The problem is today, too many of my fellow citizens actually, I would say, have unfortunate ideas. And until we actually start talking to each other more and listening to each other better, we can't go forward. But you can't blame the Constitution. You have to look in the mirror.
I would agree in terms of the danger of the lack of meaningful, open-minded conversation in this country completely. And at the same time, though, again, the very same thing that leads you to call the Constitution a hinge point in all of human history is the power of its initial ideas and how they set the template for what for this nation, okay? And I guess what I'm saying is I think it ought to be easier for us to change that or adjust that template. And look, I'm gonna lean on Thomas Jefferson himself. Wasn't it Jefferson who said that no society can make a perpetual constitution, that the earth should belong to the living generation?
And I mock him savagely in the book because he was an airhead on some of these things. And so be careful what you wish for, my friend, because John Boehner was Speaker of the House, and if he can just, you know, at any given moment amend the Constitution because he's got a simple majority, or Kevin McCarthy, or Newt Gingrich, then, you know, you might not like some of these amendments. So Thomas Jefferson wasn't even there in 1788. He said a lot of silly things. Thank God he was a hypocrite. So I say in the book, he has two flaws. He's a, you know, too much of a utopian, but he's also a hypocrite. And these flaws actually cancel out because some of his ideas were actually silly ones. And his idea that the Constitution should lapse every 19 years was actually a bad idea. Madison was horrified by it. I discuss it in pretty great detail, and I've changed my mind on all these things. If you had talked to me 40 years ago, I would have said, you know, if I ever have a son, I'm going to name him Jefferson because he's my hero. But I've changed my mind on those things because I've come to sort of see some of the complexities. And maybe I've just, you know, gotten old and crotchety. That's the other possibility, I suppose.
I'm not diminishing the importance, the urgent importance of the emergence of a very influential wing of the Republican Party, / I would say the entire Republican Party now, that is beholden to beliefs that undermine the Constitution. That is an emergency situation, and I'm not diminishing it. At the same time, though, I think that I'm just going to keep pushing this, Professor, forgive me.
Because, go for it. Now this is a conversation.
Yeah, because I hear you saying that I'm not arguing for a transformation of the fundamentals of what's in the Constitution, but by not allowing a document to go through the process, that conversational process of modernization, you end up with a kind of constitutional calcification, don't you? I mean, there are critics from, not of you, but of the Constitution from the left who say, well, the very fear that the John Boehners and Mitch McConnells of the world might propose amendments that we don't like. I mean, that is what's can lead to a frozen democracy, which is a brittle one, is it not?
I know there are people who say that with due respect. I know them extremely well. I've read everything they've written, and they're wrong. Okay? So I'll say it a different way. Again, I have testified on multiple constitutional amendments in Congress. Here are the ones I've testified on. Amendments that would have changed the First Amendment so that the government can put someone in prison for protesting government action by burning a flag. And that had majorities in the House and Senate. But thank God it didn't have two-thirds. It came close to having two-thirds, and I was opposed to that. George W. Bush had House and Senate majorities to put in the Constitution only 15 years ago a rule that marriage had to be between one man and one woman, and I think that would be wrong. ERA isn't in the Constitution textually, but in fact we have ERA today in the 14th Amendment, so even though I'd like it in the text, it's not so bad, the status quo, in fact, which is Ruth Bader Ginsburg's landmark opinion in the VMI case saying sex discrimination is usually unconstitutional, especially when it treats women as second-class citizens. It's always unconstitutional when it does that. So I know there are people who say that. I say the opposite. And I'm comfortable with my position. I used to think the way they did, and now I've actually seen the dangers of too plebiscitary a process.
Mm. Well, this has been quite the conversation, Professor Amar, and so I hope to continue with it as time goes by. Akhil Reed,
I'd love it.
Akhil Reed Amar is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale, one of the nation's most celebrated constitutional law scholars. His new book is The Words That Made Us, America's Constitutional Conversation from 1760 to 1840. Professor Amar, thank you once again.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.